Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous. So here I am in North London, just walking along Lynn Barber's Road. And when I've mentioned to anyone that I'm going to interview the famous interviewer with very strong opinions, Lynn Barber, they say, good luck! Well, God, you must be scared. But guess what? Nothing can be as scary as being shouted at by my teenage daughter this morning. So I'm really hoping that this is not going to be as scary as predicted. Do you think you can understand?
Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Lynn Barber, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
The Observer newspaper was so proud of having you writing celebrity interviews for them. They put you on billboards all over the UK saying Doner Kebabs, Tequila Slammers, interviewed by Lynn Barber, you know you'll pay. How pleased were you with that?
Thrilled, absolutely thrilled. And it was quite funny because I actually kept driving around London trying to locate all these billboards. And I had to drive quite a long way, it must be said, to find some of them. But there was one fairly near here where I made a point of sort of any time I was going to Waitrose or anything, I'd always drive past. And I got my photo taken in front of it. I loved it, yeah.
You do celebrity interviews. You call them celebrity interviews. What is a celebrity?
Yeah, I must say, you know, I seriously hate the word celebrity. Mm. And I hate saying celebrity interviews. But on the other hand, what else do you say? You know, because if you say famous people, I mean, some of them aren't really. I mean, famous sort of implies that they've done something, you know. And like I'm just doing Kim Kardashian. Well, famous for what exactly, you know? But also, there are really famous people like Lucian Freud, who I tried for years to get an interview with, who can go out in the street, go to parties without anyone recognising, or could do. So celebrity describes something, but I'm not sure exactly what it is. What it does mean, I suppose, from my point of view, is that it's a name that it can say Lynn Barber interviewing Kim Kardashian without anyone having to explain who it is, you know. And I quite like that because it saves me a lot of boring writing about their career sort of thing. But I am sort of sorry to be upholding celebrity culture in some ways.
You start with your book, A Curious Career, that you've always been nosy. How nosy are you, and can you give me an example?
Oh, I'm insanely nosy, you know. I mean, I can't rest, you know. You know, I like to know somebody's circumstances. I like to know if they're married, if they have a long history of having affairs, if they... I like to know something about their background, you know, whether they came from nowhere and sort of made their own money or whatever. But also things like whether they get on with their brothers and sisters. I mean, I'm weirdly obsessed with sibling relationships because I didn't have any brothers or sisters myself. And one thing that shocks me over and over again is the number of people I interview who have a brother or sister they've lost touch with. Are you nodding as if you do too?
Yeah, well, I've had problems with my brothers and sisters. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I sort of just cannot imagine that because, you know, as a child, I longed to have a brother and sister. So I'm always interested in that, about how families fall out or how parents get on. And, you know, because I come from really sort of boringly nuclear family, you know, two parents who were together forever and no brothers and sisters, you know, things like parents divorcing. I mean, I'm interested in all those things, which are quite commonly happen, but haven't happened to me, as it were. So I like to know.
And you're also getting to know the kind of, as you said, kind of the underneath of a person much more, aren't you? If you're getting to know how they, their
yes,
relationships.
I sort of feel if I can place them growing up and if I can place them in the context of a family and get a sort of notion of what they were like, say, as a young teenager, then I'm sort of grounded in what I'm then looking at.
Okay, so tell me about you as a young teenager.
Quite a lot of it's in the film and education. I was a very swotty schoolgirl totally on track to go to Oxford or Cambridge. I'd spent my entire life passing exams, winning scholarships. My parents just, you know, that was the whole line they sold, education, education, education. And I was on track to do that. And then I met this con man at a bus stop when I was 16 who took me out. He was much older than me, lied about his age and was probably much, much older than me. But completely wooed and won my parents, who then tried to pressure me into marrying him and said things like, you don't need to go to Oxford if you've got a good husband. And I mean, up to then, my entire life had been devoted to going to Oxford. So, I mean, that was quite a facer. But I suppose as a teenager, you know, I was a swotty schoolgirl, but I was also up for a bit of adventure. And when I got to Oxford, I became a sort of total party animal and just, you know, went out every night.
I suppose you didn't know you were a party animal until you became one.
Well, I didn't
you?
Have a yeah. chance, you know, yeah, in Twickenham yeah, with yeah. my parents. I didn't have a chance to be a yeah. party animal. But Oxford was amazing in those days because there were seven men to every woman. And if you were quite good looking, which I was, you know, you were literally asked out to lunch and dinner and cocktails and punting and this, that and the other. I mean, just beating them off with a stick, basically.
God, sounds brilliant. You say you mistrust people quite naturally. You got your mistrust actually from the con man.
Yeah.
Tell me, how does that manifest itself, a mistrust?
I think that most people go through life that if someone is nice to them and sort of pays them a few compliments and sort of chats them up a bit, not chat up in a sense or something, but just chats to them nicely.
Friendly.
Yes. I think the normal reaction is to say, oh, what a nice person, they're being nice to me, etc. Whereas my reaction, I fear, is to think, oh, why is that woman being so nice to me? What's she want? You know? And I have to be friends with somebody a long, long time. You know, I start from a position of sort of this person might be nice, might not be. I'll see how they turn out. And I probably have to be friends with somebody a really long time, like 4 or 5 years, before I totally trust them.
Wow. Now, how has this helped you with your interviewing?
Oh, it's good for interviewing, you know, because you go around with PRs telling you that this person is lovely, you know, hunky-dory, everything they say is sweetness and light. And they, when you interview them, tell them that they're, you know, too giving and that they have a wonderful sense of humour and things. And, you know, there's always a sort of sceptical voice in my head saying, well, let's test this, you know.
Yeah, because you did say, if someone says they've got a sense of humour, they haven't. If someone says I'm generous, they are tight. Now, I was terribly worried about it when I read it. Well, the sense of humour, I thought I got one, and then I thought, oh, shit, I haven't got one.
Well, no, but would you say you had one? That's the point.
No, I'd just be a hoot.
No, but I mean, that's the point. If somebody said to me, you know, describe yourself, I probably wouldn't say I've got a great sense of humour, although I think I probably do have.
You do.
And the one that really freaks me out is if they're saying, I really love my children, and you think, well, what else might you do with your children? You know, I mean, that one really is sort of alarm bells. Yeah. And, it's just I have a sort of a sceptical nature, which is fine for journalists.
Yeah, very good.
But probably also a suspicious nature. And I remember once coming back from a dinner party with David, my husband, and saying, I said, that woman was all over me. She was trying to be so friendly. What was all that about? And David said, has it ever occurred to you that she wanted to be friendly because she liked you? And I said, oh, no.
Radio Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime.
Now, your first job was on Penthouse magazine, which was an English version of Playboy, which actually had really good writers, Playboy. You were interviewing perverts, dominatrices, fetishists, anyone with any, you know, weird perversion. Did this open your mind or was it already open?
No, it did open my mind. I mean, I think my mind was already open in that I've always been open to the idea that people should explore their sexuality, even if it's in quite peculiar directions, as it were. I mean, I've never been censorious of people who have weird sex lives. But, I mean, no, I didn't know about half of these things. I mean, my first foot fetishist, I was just sort of gobsmacked, you know, and somebody fancied amputees. I mean, what? I'd never heard of that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was good for me. It was good as an interviewer because it meant that the important thing was just to get it out of them and to try and get detail the whole time. And obviously not ever to say, you know, that's disgusting, or I'm so shocked.
Must have been so different, though, because it was pre-internet, so
yeah.
This was like...
We'd never heard of this.
And no. They'd never talked to anyone.
Absolutely not.
Because there weren't support groups for...
Not. And also, you know, they'd seen this sort of regular thing in Penthouse, so they'd volunteered to be interviewed, so there was no case of having to sort of persuade them into it. I mean, they were only too eager, actually. You know, and we guaranteed anonymity. I mean, they were just a foot fetishist. It was good for me, and it also taught me this thing about that people can have double lives, because some of these people were so respectable on the outside, or so sort of not just respectable, but so sort of conventional, you know, people who worked in the city in pinstripe suits, and then they came home and changed into nappies. And that's possibly given me a rather sort of overexcited view of... But, I mean, now, if I look at somebody who seems very conventional, I always think, what's his kink, you know?
Now, you also said that Harry Fieldhouse, who was he the editor there?
Yes, I mean...
He taught you a lot.
He was so valuable. I owe him everything, really. Guccione was the founder and editor-in-chief and chief supremo, etc. But his interest was just the girls, the photographs, the girl copy. Harry was the editor who actually had to put the magazine to bed, had to do layouts, and provide all the words. And so my job, I was sort of number two and eventually number one on words. Just everything that wasn't girl photographs, basically. So you had to fill pages and pages and pages from this magazine for almost no money, you know, buying short stories or cooking up articles or whatever. But why I always say he taught me to write was that I had that sort of gushing schoolgirl way of writing that was quite attractive, but sort of gush, 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 and, you know, too prolix. And Harry would say, oh, come on, you're writing for men. They haven't got all the time in the world, you know. And his great thing was sort of fining down, saying, you don't need this word, you don't need this sentence, you don't need this paragraph. This paragraph can go straight into that one, cut out all the guff. And so I think he gave a sort of professionalism to my writing, which I needed. On the other hand, nowadays when I'm writing, I do, as it were, my gushing schoolgirl version first and then cut it back as Harry would have done.
Yeah, we'll go into that now, how you do your interviews. You do your interviews on a recorder.
Yeah.
Then you, if they're a good person, you get all the good quotes and then you write around it. Is that how you do it?
Yes, I tape it. I transcribe the tape, I think, while I'm transcribing quite a bit.
It takes a long time.
I know, yeah. It does. Yes, and then I will mark, I'll just highlight, this is an absolutely essential quote and this is possibly a useful quote, but to make sure that I do get the best quotes in somewhere or other, and then slightly write the article around them, yeah.
What happens if you got no quote?
Well, there's an example in my book of an interview with Rafael Nadal where nothing he said was of any interest. Well, that in a way is liberating as a writer. You know, I've got to fill 3,500 words. He said maybe 300 worthwhile words at the most. So I'm going to describe, I mean, in that case, I described the world of sports PR, which I hadn't sort of encountered in such a strong way, and I wanted to convey the full horror of it. And that was quite an opportunity, but I mean, I wouldn't like to have to do that sort of thing too often.
Not sports people.
Well,
or
not
people with
no quotes. But I mean, yeah. I'm always grateful if I've interviewed somebody and there's lots of good quotes. And the problem is more, how am I going to get all these good quotes into the piece without sacrificing any? On the other hand, that means I have to sort of there's not much opportunity for me to let rip, as it were. And then I let rip if there's no quotes.
What you do is you expose kind of the PR machine in the book, and you say, as you said, like actors, film stars, it's all about, oh, they can't be rude about their director, they can't be rude about the film. But you keep exposing this, but then they line up for you. I mean, what is it?
I'm not sure that the actors line up. I mean, the trouble is the PRs line up, you know. They're sort of throwing these poor actors to the wolves every single week. I mean, probably they see it as a challenge. Probably it is true to say that if I'm nice about somebody, it really counts for something, you know. And especially if once in a blue moon I'm nice about an actor, you know, that really is a sort of very exciting moment. I don't know. I mean, actors, I don't know what they think. They think they can be obliging. And their attitude is so often sort of, well, what do you want me to say? What shall I be like? And, of course, that's useless, you know. And actually, I'd much rather they were whatever, you know, whatever they're really like. But the other thing is, I slightly think actors aren't really like anything a lot of the time. I think they're a bit short of character, really.
That's really fascinating. Do you think people read you because they know that you might lay into somebody?
I fear so, yes, because it's certainly true that, you know, they call me Demon Barbara and talk about hatchet jobs. I mean, one a year maybe is a hatchet job. It's really not often. But those always are the ones that people remember. And I think it is possibly because I write them with a certain vigour. I think, you know, I never want this person to rise from the dead sort of thing. This is Lynn Barber on Radio Gorgeous.
After you'd been at Penthouse, you worked at the Express interviewing celebs, and you say that was your kind of practice period. You also say that you learnt not to be starstruck. I'm interested to know, have you been starstruck with anybody?
Yes, but it really isn't good to be starstruck. But I mean, in one of my books, I write about Jarvis Cocker. And for some weird reason, he insists on coming here to the house. So I was going around the house, sort of, as it were, looking at the photographs, thinking, oh, hide that one, you know, or my CD collection looks tragic, you know. And maybe should I leave one or two sort of intellectual books on the, do you know what I mean? Sort of behaving like a fan. And so that's really bad. And that in a way, showed how weird the whole process of interviewing is, because having him in my house, I just couldn't cope with sort of being a nice hostess and trying to be an interviewer. And he was trying to be all sort of, let's keep it real and everything. And oddly enough, he asked me to his apartment in Paris, where again, we were sort of supposedly preparing lunch for his stepson. And he just wanted it all to be ordinary. And actually, sort of, I don't really want it to be ordinary. But the other thing where occasionally I felt sort of gulp of respect or sort of, God, I'm interviewing Muriel Spark, or God, I'm interviewing Rudolf Nureyev. And it's not really a good thing, you know, because it inhibits me for a bit. I mean, I usually manage to forget about it again. But if you're in awe of your subject, you know, you probably can't do it. And certainly with Muriel Spark, I mean, I was thinking that all the way through. Wow, this is Muriel Spark. Yeah. You know? Whereas Joseph Heller, I mean, I went to interview him thinking, oh, God, you know, I worship this man, I worship this man. Since I met him, I hated him. He was really awful. You know? So that was fine, in a way. And I didn't sort of think this is the much-esteemed author of Catch-22. I thought this is a really evil, nasty, bad-tempered, horrible man. So that was fine, you know.
But then doesn't that kind of upset your dreams in a way, though? Kind of.
I don't particularly have dreams about, you know, I don't think, oh, because I'm such a fan of so-and-so, I must interview them. I know myself actually well enough now to think that if I'm such a fan of them, maybe I shouldn't interview them.
Yeah,
you know.
Like the worst interview I ever saw, Jonathan Ross, was with David Bowie. He was all blah, 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 you know.
Really? Well, Jonathan Ross was sort of polaxed with admiration.
He has worshipped him all his life, and it was just kind of sickly.
I sometimes think if I had ever got Lucian Freud, who I tried for years and years and years, it's quite possible that I wouldn't have had anything to ask him, you know.
Yeah. So you went on then and you'd literally become the celebrity interviewer, the Observer, Vanity Fair and now the Sunday Times. You're happily married with two daughters when your husband died quite suddenly of cancer. That must have been...
It wasn't actually cancer. It was something more complicated called myelofibrosis, which was sort of like leukemia. And he was told that if he had a bone marrow transplant, or said that he had 2 years to live unless he had a bone marrow transplant. And actually he died in the course of the bone marrow transplant. But, I mean, that was very freaky because... Although he'd been diagnosed with this thing, he actually had no symptoms, nothing visibly wrong with him at all, and went into hospital sort of perfectly fit. We'd been to a friend's wedding in Ireland the weekend before and danced all the weekend, you know.
I would have been angry that, you know, the doctors had said this.
I was very hung up on it for a very long time because it did feel so sudden, and also because I thought maybe they misdiagnosed, you know, maybe there was nothing wrong with him. Anyway, he died, yeah.
God. So you're now a widow. Has your life expanded? I mean, I know it's, you know, since he's gone, you know, I mean, have you kind of got more interest, more, you know, have you kind of...
It's 11 years now, so, I mean, I'm sort of used to it.
Yeah.
I suppose my social life has changed a bit in that when David was alive, we had a sort of what I think of as a dinner party social life where with... old friends that we would go to dinner parties with. And I'd get loads of, I mean, I've always got loads of invitations to sort of book launches and art things and all that stuff. But I wouldn't particularly go to them because our main social life was going out together and he didn't want to come to these things. And then when he died, I suppose I socialised more by myself and more in a sort of media context. And also became friends with Tracy Emin, who's an endless party giver.
Yeah, because you interviewed her.
Interviewed her and became friends.
Yeah, you liked her.
Well, yeah, no, I liked her. But what was sort of older was that she liked me and sort of pursued this friendship in that, which I probably wouldn't have done. But anyway, she's been a good friend and still is. And then at one stage, maybe 3 years after, I was asked to be a Turner Prize judge. And so that meant a lot more involvement with the art world and, you know, just going to loads of galleries and getting to know loads of people. So I suppose from that point of view, my social life has changed a bit. But I do very much treasure what I think of as my real old friends, who are the ones who knew me and David. And it was really funny, I went to stay with some of them. There's a whole gang of them up in Yorkshire. And they sort of said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm interviewing Kim Kardashian. These are people my age. And they said, oh, who's Kim Kardashian? And I started explaining who Kim Kardashian was. And I could see them looking really puzzled. And I said, actually, you really, really don't need to know who Kim Kardashian is. Don't ever know who Kim Kardashian is. Tell me about the hay harvest. Was it a good harvest this year and how are the horses? I value them more and more, actually, as we get older.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
The only chapter in the book I didn't read was about people interviewing you. Because I thought, if I read it, it will really put me off. Do you mind being interviewed? Do you like being interviewed? I mean, does it feel strange? Does it feel... How does it feel?
I mean, it's quite interesting. It's quite a learning experience to sort of see different people's different techniques. And actually, I wish I could remember his name, but this Irish guy who, because I've just done Dublin Book Festival, this Irish guy who, I was saying, oh, you're useless. He didn't seem to have any questions, you know. And so there were just great long silences, because I don't believe in filling somebody else's silence, as it were. And I thought, oh, he's a really incompetent interviewer. But as he left, he gave me his book of collected interviews, and I'm just knocked out by it. I mean, it's so impressive.
So he just has big pauses and waits for them to talk?
Well, I'm not quite sure what he does, but it made me realise that, you know, you can be a very different interviewer to me and still be a very good interviewer, and that actually how somebody seems to you at the time, I mean, of course, I'm talking about written interviews now, but, you know, that they can seem incompetent and then write a brilliant article, or something that used to infuriate me is that they seemed very good, asked interesting questions, I gave interesting answers, I thought, and then they didn't use them. And I mean, that's really annoying. So there's that. But I mean, I can't really generalise, you know, because I think all I learned is that I have a way of interviewing that suits me, that I'm used to, you know, but other people have different ways. My rule is that there has to be a tape recorder. I can't believe people who don't use tape recorders now. So that's very important in my view.
You also use it as a sort of weapon, don't you? Well, not a weapon, but as a tool.
It's
a ritual.
Yes, exactly. I like there to be a moment where, you know, I come into the room, blah, 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 do you want a cup of tea, blah, blah, blah. Put my tape recorder down, rather quite ostentatiously switch it on and maybe even say testing, testing, you know. But just to sort of mark the moment, sort of now we're on the record. And I don't want people to tell me things off the record, I really don't. And then at the end, I will usually sort of pick up my tape recorder and say, well, thank you very much, but is there anything you would have liked to have talked about that I haven't given you an opportunity? And sometimes they say yes, and so I put the tape recorder down again. But, yeah, I just like to bookend the idea that this is all on the record, you know.
OK, so is there anything else that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked?
No, that was very good. Thank you.
So, A Curious Career by Lynn Barber is published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much.
Good, thank you. She can walk, she can crawl.
RadioGorgeous.com